Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. What a dramatic day yesterday, or at least the run-up for the first time in a couple of years. It seems forever. Robert Mueller announced that he was going to be making a statement and came up to the podium, and the man who never speaks had a lot to say. And of course, the spin has begun and has, you know, intensified since he spoke yesterday. Quick summary of what the special prosecutor had to say was there was no hoax. This was a major Russian attack on the U.S. elections. It was not a witch hunt. He, you know, emphasized the seriousness and the honorable nature of the investigation. Obviously, no coup and no exoneration. He went to great lengths to say that his report did not exonerate President Donald Trump from charges of obstruction of justice. This is what he had to say.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision.
And then basically he said, the ball is in your court, Congress. So we brought in some heavy hitters to talk about this. Paul Rosenzweig from R Street Institute, Jeffrey Harris. Paul Rosenzweig served as a senior counsel to Ken Starr back in the 1990s. Jeffrey Harris was the principal assistant to Rudy Giuliani when he was at the Justice Department during the Reagan administration. Both of them were the signatories of that letter that said, hey, if Donald Trump was not the president of the United States, he would have been charged with obstruction of justice. So Mr. Harris, Mr. Rosenzweig, thanks so much for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's just start with this. Unless you that this, Paul, why do you think that Bob Mueller had that press conference yesterday? A press conference in which he said, basically, this is the last you're ever going to see me, the last you're going to hear from me. I really don't want to testify in front of Congress. What do you think the point of that press conference was? What was the message that he really wanted to nail down?
Well, I think there were probably three messages. Message number one was, read the report. All right. He said the report speaks for itself. Our written product controls 4 or 5 times. So message number one was read the report. Message number two was I have not been properly construed. He essentially said the way that the public is been reporting this or spinning my report is not what we intended. Here's what we said. And he gave basically a live performance of what would have been his opening statement to Congress if they'd called him. He did it in 8 minutes and he read the highlights and, you know, pretty much gave exactly what he thinks the report contains in a public performative manner, which is a good thing. Right. Anybody who's seen a play written on the page and then seen it performed knows the difference between the value of a written word and the emotional impact of speaking out loud. And then the third thing he was trying to do was say, Congress, don't waste your time calling me. Go do your job. Call the witnesses you need to, hear from them, and then make your decision. The ball is in your court.
Well, we saw what the immediate response was, not a surprise. President Trump tweeted out, nothing changes from the report. There was insufficient evidence. And therefore, in our country, a person is innocent. The case is closed. ! Thank you. Jay Sekulow basically said the same thing, put a period on a 2-year investigation that produced no findings of collusion or obstruction against the president. Jeffrey Harris, your former boss, Rudy Giuliani, of course, immediately said roughly the same thing and lashed out at Bob Mueller. So was this just nothing? Was this just nothing that happened yesterday?
Of course not. First of all, the obstruction that was set out in the Mueller report, if anything, Mueller's reading of it is very generous to the president. There are about 1,000 former prosecutors and Department of Justice people who have signed a letter saying that the evidence in the Mueller report shows obstruction of justice. And but for the fact that Trump is the president, any of us would have indicted that conduct. And none of us think it's a close call.
And you signed that letter, and we should let people know that you two are among those who are starring in a video released by Republicans for the Rule of Law today, and people can find all that. So what are the elements of that? To break that down for me, for those of us that are lay people, because of course we've heard a lot that you cannot be charged with obstruction of justice if in fact there's no underlying crime. And that the fact that Robert Mueller basically and the Justice Department decided not to bring charges, isn't that what presumed innocent means in our system?
Well, let me correct you. You certainly can be charged with obstruction of justice, even if the underlying crime that's being investigated doesn't result in charges. And, you know, one of the sort of common themes in the District of Columbia politicians who get indicted for white collar crimes is that they often get indicted for what they did to obstruct the investigation, even though they never got charged with what was in the underlying investigation. So that is just, as a matter of law, dead wrong. If you try and influence a witness, put phony documents in your files, even if the prosecutors decide that they are not going to file indictments on what they're investigating, you have committed obstruction of justice.
So let's talk also about the apparent distance between what the Attorney General Bill Barr had to say about the decision on obstruction of justice and what Bob Mueller said yesterday. Again, feel free to correct me on this. The Attorney General seemed to imply that the decision not to recommend charges against the president really had nothing to do with the Justice Department guidelines that say that you cannot indict a sitting president. And I thought that Mueller made it absolutely clear that, in fact, that was their starting point, or at least that was the suggestion, that they looked at that and realized that we will not ever be able to charge the president. And the only thing that they could do was to say that there was no evidence or there was insufficient evidence to charge him. And he pointedly, again, said that they did not exonerate the president. So, Paul Rosenzweig, talk about how Bill Barr's credibility comes out from what happened yesterday.
You're exactly right. There's no doubt, none whatsoever, that the Attorney General's public summary of what was in the report was misleading and incomplete, in my judgment, deliberately so. In the press conference just before the release of the report, he was asked that very question. Was Mueller's decision not to indict based solely on the DOJ policy against indicting a sitting president? And Barr said point blank, no, it was not. He told me it was not. And yesterday, Robert Mueller said it was. There is no doubt. That was my starting point. It was the basis for my decision. There may have been other parts to it, too, and Mueller didn't speak to that. But there is absolutely no way to listen to what the Attorney General said or, frankly, to read his summary of the summaries in the 4-page letter he sent to Congress on the day he received the report and not think that he was deliberately misconstruing what the Mueller report contained.
I suppose one of the big questions would be why Bill Barr would do that, knowing that the report was going to be coming out on the heels of his comments. You know, I mean, and it's always difficult to get into the motivation of someone. But given Barr's position, given his reputation, given the fact that clearly people were going to find out that the story was different, why did he do it?
Well, you know, if you look at the trajectory of Barr becoming Attorney General again, the first thing he does is he writes an unsolicited 18-page letter to the Attorney General, which is basically an audition for the part, an audition to President Trump to let him know that he thinks the investigation is a witch hunt. That attracts him to President Trump. Trump nominates him. And then he issues this 4-page letter. And the most significant thing is that he then holds the report for 2 to 3 weeks. And why did he do that? He wanted to give the president a chance to do his victory lap and to form public opinion before the report comes out. So I think there is no question that Bill Barr had his finger on the scale, and he was put his finger on the scale to help President Trump. And that is something that no attorney general of the United States should ever do.
Okay, let's talk about what happens now. I thought it was very, very clear from what Bob Mueller said that he was, I mean, all but, you know, making sign language to Congress that this report very clearly is a referral of information to them because it was not possible to deal with the president's potential criminal activity, the obstruction of justice, through the criminal justice system. And the only way, therefore, to deal with the presidential misconduct at this level was the congressional impeachment process. And he seemed to make it very, very clear, even though he's not very anxious to testify, that this was virtually a referral to Congress. And virtually is probably an unnecessary word. Do either of you disagree with that?
He didn't use the I word, as President Trump would call it. So it's clearly a call to Congress to investigate. I wouldn't say that he had reached a conclusion that impeachment was the right answer, at least not from any of his public statements. You can sort of infer it from his findings as to obstruction of justice and his cautious reservation of possible post-presidential obstruction charges against the newly made a citizen Donald Trump after he leaves office. But I think essentially you're reading it correctly, that this was a statement by Mueller, exactly as he'd said in the report, to be fair, that my job is done here. It's your job now. Now, we can disagree with how he finished his job or not like it, but he's saying, I've done everything I'm going to do. It's on you, Congress.
You know, if you look at the prosecutorial role, so I, as a prosecutor, if I investigated a case and asked the grand jury to indict, and then the case goes to trial, the one thing I don't do, and it would be improper for me to do it, is to testify as a witness at that case. So what I think Bob Mueller is saying is, look, you know, I've dug up as much evidence as I can, and the people that have to make the case are the witnesses, not me as the prosecutor. I can argue inferences, but you need the basic testimony of fact witnesses. And that is the way our system works. And maybe that's what Mueller was referring to. I hope it was.
Well, he was also making clear that he wasn't going to say anything more than what he's already said. And, you know, I do think he was basically saying, you know, read the report, read the damn report. I wrote it all out for people to see. But you could also imagine that, and by the way, I don't know whether you agree or not. I assume that at some point he will testify either privately or publicly. He didn't rule it out. He just said he didn't want to do it. But there's certainly great value to having him saying these words on television in front of Congress. And I think what happened yesterday illustrated that because, of course, you know, when he talked about obstruction of justice and the fact they did not exonerate the president, he did not say anything that was not in the report. But hearing him say it felt like a whole category shift, that it was very different watching. It's like watching the movie as opposed to reading the book.
Well, I'll throw this to Paul because it's just what Paul said when he started, you know, that if you want to get the attention of the American people, make it a movie, don't make it a book.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Mueller's argument, though, and frankly, why I would probably guide Congress away from wasting its time on calling Mr. Mueller is he already did it. He gave us 8 minutes or 9 minutes yesterday, and you know, the average opening statement in Congress is 5 minutes. So he gave us a double-sized opening statement. He will, if you call him, he will read the exact same statement again, and then will be followed by 5 hours of tendentious questioning to every one of which he will answer, it's in the report on page 27, or it's not in the report, so I can't answer that. I think I'm with Jeffrey. I think it might be good as performative art, but at this point, Congress should go and talk to Hope Hicks, Don McGahn, Ms. Donaldson, Corey Lewandowski, you name it. All those folks are ripe for investigative inquiry.
I could certainly imagine a congressman, you know, asking a question and having Mueller say it's on the footnote of page 27, and then the congressman saying, "Could you read it for us?" Just to hear it from Mueller's voice. So, okay, so what should Congress do at this point? I want to read you something that Ben Wittes wrote at Lawfare about. He's written a pretty long piece here, but he says, look, Congress's current strategy is an incoherent muddle. While individual Democratic leaders may well have their eye on the ball, the aggregate output of the disparate committee chairs has reflected no discernible strategy. Some, judging from their statements, seem focused on getting the full unredacted Mueller report and the investigative work product that underlies it. When, why exactly this is the focus is unclear to me. The marginal information Congress is likely to gain from the full report is small. And then he basically said the committees have shown limited interest in actually unpacking in public the voluminous material that Mueller has publicly reported and is thus readily available for discussion. The absence of public hearings on the contents of the report can only be blamed in part on Don McGahn's decision to honor the president's claims of executive privilege. Big part of the story here is that the key committees are just not pursuing a focused oversight agenda involving live testimony by the key witnesses in a fashion that is likely to prove effective. Now, I had taken the position that it wasn't necessary to open an impeachment inquiry to pursue this, that what the Congress should do was exactly what Ben Wittes was talking about, to have those live hearings to unpack all of that information. So, gentlemen, what should they do now? Given the fact that Bob Mueller is all but inviting them to move ahead with impeachment, then that's overstating it. But what do you think Congress should do? If Jerry Nadler called you up today and said, all right, should we pull the trigger or not?
Well, what I would do is if I were Jerry Nadler, I'd have my attaché case full of subpoenas and I'd start passing them out. For example, McGahn declining to testify because of executive privilege strikes me as without a foundation. First of all, he's already told the government what he has to tell them. So if there was a privilege, it's waived. The privilege is limited to conversations he had with the president. But there is a lot more they want to ask McGahn. So what I would do is I'd start subpoenaing witnesses. And then I would, if I had to, I'd litigate the privilege issue because I think that's a loser for the president on about 90% of the assertions of executive privilege. And I think the American people, by hearings or even if you started an impeachment inquiry for the sole purpose of getting people to testify, I think that's what needs to be done. I'm curious as to why there seems to be a reluctance to use the subpoena power that the Congress has. What seems to happen is they issue a subpoena after a lengthy hand-wringing, and then they start negotiations with the person subpoenaed. When I used to issue subpoenas, I didn't negotiate whether they would show up in the grand jury. They showed up, or a couple of agents would go pick them up.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Congress doesn't have any agents to go send. The sergeant at arms is going to have to bulk up his staff if we. I have a slightly different take. I agree with Jeffrey that we should start doing real investigations. My focus, however, would be people outside of the executive branch who can't plausibly claim any privilege at all. For example, the subpoena to Deutsche Bank and to Mazur's his accounting company. Those are both third parties who have no privileges and they're standing by. I think the courts will dispose of those quickly, and I think that there's no chance at all of losing them. I think that what would be damaging to the investigation is if Trump caught a lucky break and won a privilege fight or two in the district court, even if it took some time to reverse on appeal. He'd tout that as evidence of overreach. So I would start outside the government, move inside. I do also think that Congress needs to figure out a way of enforcing its subpoenas that is legitimate. And if it takes, withholding funds from the executive branch or some such, they should do that because it's just not going to be effective to keep wishing somebody to show up and have them say no.
In line with what Paul just said, one thing that struck me in the Mueller report as curious is the statement that Don Jr. declined to testify. Don Jr. is a private citizen. I'm not sure why Mueller was okay with that.
Speculation is that he wasn't. Right. There's a redaction right after that that's labeled 6E. Most of us are guessing that means that Don Jr. was then compelled and refused asserting a Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. That's a guess. I want to make sure that everybody who's listening understands that's speculation. I have no facts at all, but it's a darn good guess.
So a lot of this is technical. or the kind of thing that we do need lawyers to unpack. But there seems to be one overriding concept that I think you know cuts across some of the partisan tribalism, and that people just get at a visceral level, which is the point: no one in our system is above the law. But at the heart of what we're debating right now is whether or not Donald Trump, because he is the president, is in fact above the law. And that if Congress does not initiate impeachment proceedings, then there literally is no recourse for a president that violates laws or commits acts that would put any of the rest of us, any other American, in legal jeopardy. So this goes to the question of the obligation of Congress to do something, that if Congress decides not to open impeachment, aren't they really saying, and it's the position of the Department of Justice, that there are no criminal charges that can ever be brought against the president, that then isn't that basically saying that Donald Trump as president is above the law?
Yes, and that's wrong. I mean, just to unpack that a bit, the Department of Justice opinion is itself, I think, wrong. It is, you know, it is not an unreasonable opinion, but for a lot of reasons, most of which were laid out in a lengthy analysis done for the office of Ken Starr's independent counsel by the constitutional scholar Ron Rotunda, it's just not sustainable that a president is immune from criminal prosecution. I mean, imagine the hypothetical that today the president goes into the family quarters and kills Melania, right? And is that not capable of criminal redress until he leaves office in 2 or 6 years? That seems ludicrous to me. But even accepting that, if we accept that, then that makes the obligation on Congress all the greater to take some form of action. And I mean, I'm going to defend Nancy Pelosi a little bit. I don't think she's saying no impeachment. I think she's saying no impeachment now. She's waiting to time it. I think that she rightly perceives that there's not a unified public support for it. And frankly, if I were counseling her, you asked what I, Jerry Nadler, I would say, let's make sure that the biggest and best hearings are in September and October of next year.
Jeffrey, I know you have some strong feelings about that Office of Legal Counsel opinion that the president cannot be charged. And Bob Mueller made some comments about it that I know you disagreed with.
Well, first, let me state that the opinion, which first reviews the 1973 opinion and then goes on from there, is 39 pages of single-spaced text that I doubt anyone who's listening to my voice has actually read. But what it basically says, with the exception maybe Paul sitting here with me, what it basically says, to put it in its simplest thing, is that the president can't be indicted because he's a very important fills a very important role in our country. And the workings of the presidency would not work well in terms of foreign policy and ability to execute the office. That's why he shouldn't be indicted. Bob Mueller said this morning that it is that the opinion found that it was unconstitutional to indict a sitting president. Bob Mueller is just wrong about that. The opinion says actually just the opposite. It says, we find that it is not a violation of the Constitution to indict the president, but we don't think it should be done for the reasons that we state, which are the balancing between the branches and also the ability of a president on the world stage to conduct the affairs of the United States. So I think Mueller is wrong. And when he characterizes the way he did, but that's really what the opinion says, that, you know, put it in the vernacular, it would screw up the president's ability to do his job.
Right, which is a very pragmatic approach. But, you know, as you point out, Paul, you can come up with all sorts of scenarios that would render that opinion absolutely absurd and that nobody would actually defend, because nobody would argue that if the president went in the middle, you know, shot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue. I mean, sure, Sean Hannity would defend it, but would he be immune from arrest and prosecution for that? And ought he to be? I'm not sure that anybody. Well, look, you always find somebody that will argue anything, but that would make the president above the law. Now, here, of course, impeachment is inevitably you know, entangled with politics. It's never a pure decision. And that's why I'm also a little bit sympathetic with Nancy Pelosi. But it is interesting, in the last several days that you have had these double bumps. You have Mueller's statement, which I think was an invitation to Congress to pursue what he's already written in his report. And then you have Justin Amash, Republican congressman from Michigan, making a very, very powerful case, not just that the attorney general had misled the public, but also that the president had committed impeachable acts. He is not backing off. He is doubling down. And I think it's kind of an extraordinary moment where you see this maverick Republican making a stronger, more eloquent, more coherent case for impeachment than I'm hearing from any of the Democrats. And I wonder whether that's creating a certain political momentum on top of the obvious legal issues that we've been discussing.
Well, it certainly seems that way. I was struck the other day. I saw, I think it was like Representative Katie Hill. She represents one of those swing districts. She's a new Democrat who just joined the Congress and from a district that's kind of 50-50, maybe even a little pro-Trump. And she was saying that a month ago, calls to her office were running 2-1 against impeachment. And I think she was on MSNBC and she said today they're running 3-1 in favor. And so I think that kind of evidence of a possible tipping point is significant. And that's probably, to my mind, what Speaker Pelosi is waiting for, is to a point where it's a loser's game if she begins the impeachment proceedings and Trump gets reelected and the Democrats lose their majority in the House. That would be the worst possible result from her perspective, in my opinion, from America's perspective. But so that's what she's playing against. And if Katie Hill can survive the opening of an impeachment inquiry, that's a big sign.
Yeah, well, that's what's been so disappointing about their failure so far, because I think that what I had envisioned in my brief moment of optimism was that they were going to have these hearings that would, you know, for lack of a better term, educate the public, you know, provide the more of the details that you and I know are in the Mueller report, which most American have not read. If people see that on television, if they begin to see it unpacked, described in detail, then public opinion can shift. And it doesn't need to shift dramatically, 20, 30 points, even, you know, 5-6 point swing in public opinion as you begin to focus attention. One thing that Donald Trump has really been good at has been focusing attention on issues that he cares about. The Democrats have been very poor at it, but had they pounded away and focused attention on this, the evidence of the corruption, the scope of the corruption, the questions that have been raised, the evidence that has already been amassed, then maybe you would have laid the groundwork for Congress people like that to be able to stand up and go to their constituents and say it is time for Congress to exercise its constitutional obligation to impeach the president.
You know, one thing that I think probably weighs heavily on Nancy Pelosi's mind is that even if the president is impeached in the House, he gets tried in the Senate, and there's virtually no chance that such fair-minded lawyer senators like Lindsey Graham wants to hear the evidence. He will not be convicted in the Senate. And the question I think that probably is in the back of Speaker Pelosi's mind is, if that were to happen, if he were to get impeached and then acquitted, does that strengthen his hand materially? And should we go down that road? I think she's
afraid. I'll amp that up a bit and say, what if they begin an impeachment inquiry but then don't deliver impeachment? That would be, you know, Donald Trump would say, even the Democrats who hate me couldn't impeach me, you know. And so there are a lot of off ramps here that lead to bad results for Ms. Pelosi. And I understand why she doesn't want to take them. In some platonic ideal, the opening of an impeachment inquiry is absolutely the right thing to do. I don't think that anybody who's read the report would disagree with that. But we don't live in a platonic ideal world.
Well, and you also make the point that there's no reasonable scenario which you begin the impeachment inquiry and you don't finish it. I mean, once you basically, you know, take the gun off the wall and load it and cock it, you damn well better fire it.
You know, one thing that's in the Department of Justice opinion about indicting the president, they discuss whether juries of ordinary people are capable of trying the president. And they conclude that it's better left in the hands of Congress. First of all, that sounds like something out of maybe 14th century England.
Yeah.
But the fact that the Justice Department opinion makes light of the ability of American juries to try someone as powerful as the president is just repugnant to our system.
It is interesting, the number of Democratic candidates in the last 24 hours who've already come out and said, you know, if I'm president, we're going to be changing those guidelines. You know, that'll be one of the first things we will do, is that we will eliminate that, because you're right. I think that, again, going back to this, the sort of the gut sense that no one is above the law, it is kind of surprising to realize the way in which our system really has been kind of an honor system, assuming that there were honorable men and women who would be holding the levers of power, would be sitting in the Oval Office, and that the system as it is set up, you know, might not actually apply to the president of the United States, that he might not have the same rules and regulations that bind the rest of us. And I'm not sure that's a principle that we Americans want to defend.
Yeah, well, but it is the principle on which, you know, we were founded. I'm reminded of the debates about the president's pardon power, and George Mason, I think it was, objected to it on the grounds that it was unchecked and could be used to do anything like pardon his co-conspirators. To which Madison responded, "Well, first off, we're never going to have anybody that bad, and second off, if we do, we'll just impeach him and get him out of there." And that really is the fundamental deal that we made: great power exercised responsibly with a check from outside. And the exercise responsibly piece is being degraded every day by President Trump, and the with checks from outside is being degraded every day principally by Republicans in the House and Senate.
You know, one other thing that I find interesting, and it may explain some of the angst with the Mueller report, and Paul can speak to this better than I can, but after the Ken Starr inquiry, the rules were changed so Mueller is a creature of the Justice Department. He answers to Barr. He answered to Jeff Sessions before he recused himself. And so we have someone looking to investigate, but is not really an independent agent to do that. Paul, when you were involved in those kinds of investigations, you were under a different set of rules.
Completely independent of the Department of Justice. And, you know, we in America have swung back and forth. The independent counsel law was a reaction to Nixon's firing, the Saturday Night Massacre, and his resistance to the Watergate inquiries. But then we found with Starr, and again, also some say with Walsh, that you give an independent counsel free rein and he just goes, he becomes a little monomaniacal. And so we decided to get rid of that and go back to the Watergate model. So we are swinging like a pendulum back and forth.
In the few minutes we have left, over the weekend, the Attorney General got the plenary power to declassify all of the evidence about the all of the information about the beginning of this Russia probe, that he can override the CIA or the NSA or any of these other agencies. And of course, in Trump world, this is being touted as, well, Sebastian Gorka, the release of the Kraken, as a way to go after the silent coup and the investigators who may have committed treason. Just your thoughts about this, because we've spent, you know, several years now talking about the attacks on our institution and the resiliency of our institution. You know, this is not taking place in a vacuum, whether, you know, the Democrats decide to impeach or not. The Trump folks, with the Attorney General as the tip of the spear, seems to be on the offense and is certainly, you know, making public threats of criminally charging members of law enforcement who actually investigated the president.
Well, it's really a sad day that we've reached this point. You know, I have little doubt that if the CIA was forced to reveal sources and methods that would endanger some of our intelligence people and our assets in the field, Trump would be fine with that as long as it protected Trump. I think he cares about nothing but himself. He's and he acts that way. And if our government has to go down in flames, if the country has to suffer grievous losses, as long as the Trump properties continue to have good income, so be it.
It really is quite remarkable. You know, in any other context, you know, the devolution of that authority to the Attorney General instead of to the DNI would probably be unremarkable. You know, we would repose confidence in the Attorney General to exercise it appropriately, as we do in the Director of National Intelligence. It is precisely because this Attorney General has so diminished his own credibility that we sitting here are concerned. And the only hope we have is that the remaining adults in the room, like the director of the CIA, Gina Haspel, and the director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, stand up if they see the Attorney General going over the cliff and say, no, we won't give you the sources and methods because you will release them, and that would be wrong. I if they're listening, I call on you, Gina. Say no. Just say no.
Yeah, that would be the road that we're heading in is really scary. You know, not to mention the normalization of accusing people of your political opponents and critics of treason, which of course carries the death penalty. That if this becomes normalized, what that does to our political culture. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. And people ought to go online and look at for the Republicans for the Rule of Law video that is being released today. Paul Rosenzweig and Jeffrey Harris. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.